From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the April 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Never Alone. Bletchley Park's latest temporary exhibition is called Never Alone and asks what happens when everything is connected. Based on an exhibition developed and designed by the National Science and Media Museum, Never Alone explores the popularity and power of smart devices. There are now more devices connected to the internet than people on the planet. Smart gadgets are becoming part of our lives, making us safer, bringing people together, and making everyday tasks easier. In the exhibition, we explore issues behind these gadgets. We discover some wartime objects and stories that show how concerns about privacy and surveillance aren't unique to the internet age. You're invited to think about the decisions you make when you click OK and to consider what being connected means to you. In this episode, we meet two people who have loaned us objects for display, ethical hacker Ken Munro of Pen Test Partners and local museum professional Amy Doolan. We start by taking a tour of the exhibition in Hut 12.
Erica, can we pick up where we left off last July? Because our listeners may remember that last July, when we reopened the museum, we were talking about our new exhibition that's in Hut 12, Never Alone, and how we were looking forward to welcoming people to it. And then, obviously, things have happened.
A lot has happened.
So, should we go in?
I think it would be lovely if I could show you around the exhibition.
I think it would be.
I tell you, do come in.
Now, with the museum reopening very shortly, finally, we get to show people this exhibition. So can you tell me what Never Alone is about?
Never Alone, it's our latest temporary exhibition. As you say, it's in Hut 12. It's sort of in the far end of the park and it stands alone. So it's for visitors kind of once they're in the park, they can kind of head to the back and explore it. It's an exhibition that introduces our visitors to questions about smart devices, about gadgets that are all connected to the internet and connected to each other. It's a touring exhibition that has been brought to us by the National Science and Media Museum, and we've kind of bletchlified it a little bit, which is my verb of the day.
I think that's fair though, isn't it? I mean, we were the birthplace of modern computing, so I think we're allowed to, aren't we?
It's a really good link actually, but it's not the only one we've been able to create in the exhibition. And as we go round, I'll point out some of the other areas where there are some quite surprising connections between the questions raised by modern devices. And I say questions, positive and negative aspects.
Yeah.
And also some of what Bletchley Park and its associated organisations were doing during World War II.
I guess in a way, especially after the year that we've all had, where people have been more connected, we couldn't ask for a better exhibition really, could we?
It was a really interesting exhibition to put questions to our visitors before lockdown. But now, it's strange because I feel like our audiences will potentially come with a different perspective to what they would have come with before lockdown.
Yeah.
In terms of things like track and trace and using your phone to stay connected and Zoom and all the various devices that we might have in our house where we're all spending a lot more time.
Yeah.
So it's something that's actually, I've been furloughed for part of the time during lockdown and I've actually been thinking about this exhibition while I've been at home. Things that we say in this exhibition are actually relevant to everyday life. And some of the questions, and we literally directly ask visitors some questions, some of those I'm actually thinking, good point. Yeah, actually, maybe I'm changing my mind a little bit on that.
Let's go around a little bit and show me some of the highlights of this then.
So the exhibition, as we come into Hut 12, we're met by sort of large Never Alone intro panel, which tells us that the exhibition is about connected devices, that by the end of 2017, there were 8.3 billion smart devices. That's a phenomenal amount of data running around this world that we're all connecting into and using to connect to each other and also sending out to, well, who knows where.
Now, a lot of our listeners will know what a smart device is, but for those who don't, what do we call a smart device?
A device that connects via Wi-Fi, connects via the internet to something. It may be like your phone has, obviously, is enabled to access photographs and media and browse the internet, but also things like light bulbs in your house that you can turn on using your phone, like Amazon Alexa, like a Fitbit. Maybe people are wearing trackers and fitness trackers, or even some people have thermostats in their house that they can set the temperature, for example, on different times and different zones. But there's all sorts of devices out there, not just these really familiar ones, but there are some devices that you would never even imagine are connected to the internet, or which you have to sign up to and share your data or share something about yourself with either the manufacturer or with the supplier.
And we're going to look later in the programme at that side of things with Ken Munro, aren't we?
Absolutely. No relation, I should say.
No.
But yes.
There's no nepotism here.
In the exhibition, we hit visitors straight away with a question. And when I say a question, we have, it's a bit retro, it's a bit old fashioned, but we have some voting booths with old fashioned tokens. It means that we can then wash them and quarantine them, and they are COVID safe ways of people voting.
I've actually seen them in a washing up bowl being washed.
So we like to keep our visitors safe. So they can take one of the clean tokens and pop them in a yes or no tower where we ask, do you own any smart devices? And there are still some tokens left here from when we shut the gallery at last time, frozen in time. And even from here, we can see that the majority of our visitors are saying, yes, they have at least one smart device. Although not insignificant number
don't. It's probably, what would you say, 80-20?
Yeah, maybe a quarter of our visitors so far have said that they don't own a smart device. And actually, it might be that there's something in this exhibition for both of these groups. People that own smart devices, that know all about them, whose houses are wired for sound, but then are seeing something new, or maybe thinking about things in ways they never have before. But also people who aren't familiar with smart devices, there's plenty in here for them to see and find out about. Moving further into the exhibition, it's divided into some zones. There's four main zones we have. Yeah. So we have smart home, tracking, surveillance, and bias. And smart home is our largest zone. We kind of put it first because that's the area where our visitors are more likely to see things that they might have in their own house.
And there's more and more of these smart devices. Well, it's called smart home, isn't it?
Absolutely. And some people's homes are absolutely chock full of these things. You know, their Wi-Fi networks are groaning under the weight of light bulbs or ring doorbells or sockets that are set to work from your mobile phone, Amazon or Google speakers or smart speakers of any brand. But some of the other kind of more unusual things that we're displaying are, for example, a smart kettle, which is a Wi-Fi enabled kettle, a pet feeder, which actually is not a bad idea that you can program to dispense a certain amount of feed over a certain amount of time and has a camera in the top. So even if you're away, you can watch Fido chewing and even talk to your animal to soothe them whilst they have their meal.
I hadn't seen the feeder, I must admit, or the kettle. But there's so many things now. I produce another podcast that's a mobile tech podcast, and the guys on that, just every episode, they blow me away with the smart devices that they're suddenly getting. But it's just growing each and every month, isn't it? And that's the problem. These things are growing and people need to learn about them, don't they?
Yes. Yeah, but there's so much choice out there as well. And some of the things people will hear in this exhibition are slightly negative. We talk about the threats that are inherent with these devices and sharing data. But also, these are making our lives better.
Yeah.
They're making them more efficient. I mean, being away from home and being able to speak to your postie who turns up with a parcel, knowing that, for example, the temperature will be fine when you get home or whilst you're away for a long period of time. Mm. The security cameras and things that you can have available in your house that are connected to Wi-Fi, and particularly things like baby cameras. So there's some of this. Yes, maybe a Wi-Fi connected kettle is a bit bonkers, but some of the other things genuinely do make people's lives smoother or more efficient.
Yeah.
And I think we can, those of us with smart devices, and I have to admit I am one of those, can definitely say that they've made our lives better.
Oh, yes, definitely. So tracking or surveillance, which one next? They're kind of linked, I guess, aren't they?
They are. We've actually got surveillance first. And we have a showcase of objects that we've used to kind of illustrate this. And when I say we've bletchlified the exhibition a little bit, we've done an interesting juxtaposition of modern day Wi-Fi connected devices with bletchly devices. So when we're talking about surveillance, for example, with the bletchly side of things, we're referring to listening in to the enemy. We bring in the stories of the Y service, women and men sitting with headsets at radio sets, listening in to the Morse communications of the enemy. And it's audio surveillance, effectively, one of the most basic ways of listening to radio, which is free for everybody to hear, but encrypted. in a similar way that data is out there and potentially may be grabbed even if it's encrypted. And so we wanted to show that the idea of surveillance, it's not a new concept where we're talking maybe hidden Wi-Fi cameras and cameras in, you know, the most discreet parts of your house. Actually, surveillance is something that has a much broader context. We also have some wonderful photographs about surveillance from 1960s Berlin, where it seems quite a modern concept, but there were cameras set up, CCTV systems in Berlin, which then hooked people's televisions in their houses to those cameras so parents could be indoors watching their kids playing outdoors with the CCTV cameras. So it's, again, something, it's not new. We're talking, we have stories here from the 1930s and 40s through the 60s to the modern day.
You see, I thought you were going to say then this was some Stasi-based East German, you know, oh, we're surveilling everyone. That's actually quite a good
positive
idea.
Positive surveillance, absolutely. And I think that's important to make the point that it's not all sinister, even when we're talking about surveillance. I mean, the Y stations, if we're using that as a reference for audio surveillance, again, there's a positive aspect to that. So it's quite a variety of things we're able to show or to put context for surveillance. My favourite is the Kayla doll. And actually, I think we might talk a bit later to Ken Monroe about Kayla, because she's an interesting toy. We've got a number of toys here in our exhibition, both in the smart home section and in surveillance. And the smart home is educational toys that connect to the Wi-Fi. We've put Kayla in our surveillance section, and we'll find out a little bit more about why we've done that later. So our tracking section of the exhibition, the section's going to get smaller and smaller as you go through. And in this section, we have a showcase of quite small items. But again, we've got some wartime items to show what we could possibly mean by wartime tracking and then modern day tracking. So the Bletchley Park side of things, we actually have index cards. Now, there's tons and tons of index cards in Bletchley Park's collection, thousands of index cards referring to all sorts of minutiae, individuals. There's a card for all sorts of enemy personnel, Germans, Japanese, but also vessels, weapons, places. And Bletchley just sort of ran on this enormous number of different indexes.
And these cards, they're just small. What size are they? 3 by 4 inches?
Standard index card size, sort of small index card. But that's that handwritten, that analog approach to data capture. And these cards are fantastic. You can read on the top line an individual's name, such as Rundstedt, Field Marshal, or Ito, Colonel, for a Japanese officer. And on each line is the reference that was made to that person in a particular message, as well as the date that message was sent and a reference number. So von Rundstedt, for example, German general commanding the Central Army Group, is how he was referred to in a message on the 27th of June 1941. And then we have April 1942, November 1942, February 1942, and again and again and again, mentioned.
Yeah.
And it's just this incredible level of detail about how frequently they were mentioned, but also what was said about them. And some of these cards have really incredible detail about illnesses, for example, or attending someone's wedding or going to a different location. It's important to know the locations of these particularly prominent people. And Bletchley was doing this from the information gathered from intercepted messages.
And this is how they're, as we say, tracking these people, isn't it, during the war. Someone gets a message for Field Marshal Rundstedt in 1942. Then they go to the card and they add the new information to it.
Yes.
And they can look back and see, oh, right, he's done this before. That might mean that he's going to do this next.
Exactly. And some of it's information tracking. Some of it's literally physically tracking. So things like receives message about passports in April 1942, Major Kato. It's so minute, the level of information, but it's that being able to track their activities as well in such a detailed way. And it's an element of Bletchley's work that perhaps is less well known than cracking codes and ciphers. And this is the laborious handwritten way of being able to basically log the fruits of that labour.
And the modern side of tracking, we're going to talk to another guest later about that, aren't we?
We are, yes. We do have a display here of mostly wrist-based tracking devices. And we'll be talking to one of our guests later about a couple of those in particular. But again, it's another really familiar object that our visitors might know. I'm literally wearing a Fitbit right now.
Yeah.
Other wrist trackers are available. We share all of this data with the companies that provide this service to us. is it a sacrifice or is it a, you know, just reaping the benefits of this? And again, we actually ask our visitors certain questions throughout the exhibition about how they feel about surveillance, tracking, and so on.
It's a negotiation, isn't it? Because you've got this device and what it adds to your life, but at the same time, you have to realise that you have to hand over some of your information about that, which is the transaction that you're really basing this whole process around, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's a compromise. Yeah. And I suppose the question is, do we know what we're compromising? When you say some of our information, it sounds very good you saying that. But actually, if you could tell me what that information is that you're sharing. I mean, we know we share our contact details, our, you know, name, but also things like our location, our heart rate, our health symptoms, our weight, what food we eat, what calories we intake, how much water we drink, and also where we share location. Can that be cross-referenced with other things? Yeah. You know, do we know what's being done with that data? It all sounds very sinister. But also, it really is helping me keep my step count up, and it's helping me be able to log my health and fitness.
Yeah.
And from a personal aspect, it's a huge benefit, and I almost compartmentalize the risk.
Yeah.
And I think most people do that.
Does that lead us to bias?
It does. Our final section is called bias. And this is quite a small section, but we really wanted to include this because the panel that we have here is actually called When Good Data Goes Bad. So information that can be gathered by things like facial recognition systems, which are more prevalent than perhaps we realize, and the use of them is only increasing. But those systems, biometric systems and facial recognition systems, are programmed by humans, and humans are fallible. Hmm. And the data sets that go behind those systems in order to recognize facial features can potentially be subject to bias and to inadvertent or overt prejudice. So we're really lucky. We're actually able to show a couple of films by an American artist and campaigner, Joy Buolamwini. And she talks about facial recognition systems because she's a programmer. She actually says that sometimes when she's coding these systems, she wears a white mask. She's black. And the systems often don't recognize her. Yeah. Disproportionately, black women are subject to not being recognized by facial recognition systems or being recognized in a derogatory way, such as old men, for example. And it's fascinating the way she's able to represent this and talk about it. So visitors to the exhibition, that's a real highlight. I really recommend watching those.
Which leads us quite neatly, after thinking about good data going bad, to the end of the exhibition.
Yes, we talk about an artwork by an artist called Dima Yaravinsky, which is called I Agree. And this artwork, he replicated basically the terms and conditions for a number of popular devices, Fitbit, for example, and Amazon. And he wrote these terms of service on a sort of long sheet of, I want to say paper, but it was actually longer than that. It took up most of a room. It's incredible how long these terms and conditions agreements can actually be. So for example, for a Fitbit, when printed at standard sort of font size, it's 9.5 meters long and contains nearly 17,000 words. That's a reason why we haven't been able to include the artwork actually in our exhibition, but it was so important that we wanted to talk about it and share that information with our visitors. Yeah. You can have a look at his artwork at dimayaravinsky.com/I-agree. I really recommend taking a look if you're online, because it's completely compelling how many words are included in these agreements and how obvious it is that we don't.
No one's ever going to read them, no.
No, absolutely. In fact, we specifically ask our visitors in one of our fantastic analog voting towers next to it, do you always read the terms and conditions? And about half have said yes compared to no. So we've got, I think it's double the number of people have said no, they don't always read the terms and conditions.
Yeah.
And I think the people who've put a token into the yes column might be fibbing.
I think that's far too many people.
Yeah. I mean, when we say always read the terms and conditions, when you update something, for example, on your phone and you scroll to the bottom, yes, 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 whatever, yes, agree. Or if you have a new app or if you have a new device and you just want to get it started and going and you sign into the system, do you sit there and read every word that they're talking about how your data is used?
I think when they say, do you always read the terms and conditions, that doesn't include the line that says, please read the terms and conditions means yes.
Who am I to judge? It may be that our visitors are particularly assiduous in reading terms and conditions.
They may be very tech savvy and safety savvy.
Absolutely. And who am I to judge? Because it's an exceedingly laudable thing if you're willing to read the terms and conditions and if you're willing to proceed accepting that, then absolutely. But I probably bet the majority of us don't, I would say. And looking at the number of people who voted here, I think our visitors tend to agree. They don't always read the terms and conditions for absolutely everything. But that is the means by which companies are able to inform us on how our data is being used or what these devices are actually doing and how they're affecting our lives. And probably it is a lesson to be learned that I'm not preaching, but maybe we should take a little bit more time and have a look at what it is. And if we read them, do we know what it means? And do we care?
There were various different ways in which we heard the traffic from the German ships. If these were what they called Schnellboote, we called E-boats, which were coming over to attack the convoys, they were obviously talking in plain language. And they might say things to each other like, Achtung, englische Schiffe, links, or whatever it was. Well, they wouldn't say links, which is left. But they would talk to each other in plain language. Sometimes we picked up a bit of chat between bases and ships. For instance, I remember one of the German Schnellboot captains was called Bobby Fimmen. And I remember we picked up a signal which said, did you know Bobby Fimmen's crew are all going on leave? And the other signalman replied, oh, they are going to make children what? Ach, sie werden Kinder machen was. And this kind of information was quite useful. But most of what they said, of course, was operational. But what we mostly listened to was code. The Germans used an alphabetic code, the beginning of which was Alpha, Bertha, Caesar, Dora, Emil, Fritz, Gustav, and so on. If they were doing spoken plain language messages, they would start off with their call signs from somebody to somebody, and then go into groups, which might be three letters, Anton, Dora, Dora, or Emil, Fritz, Hans. And we would write down in English, A-D-D-E-F-H, or whatever it was, on our message blocks. So what Bletchley got was groups of three letters, four letters, or sometimes five letters on a message block, as we had heard it. But of course, the letters, the same in German or English, and this was what they were decoding.
I'm Ken Munro. I'm an ethical hacker and security researcher. I work for a firm called Pentest Partners, and our job is to hack things with permission, but to make them more secure. And over the last few years, we've been looking at the Internet of Things, all those smart devices. Now, are they helping you or are they spying on you?
Ken, we're here in the exhibition, and I see you have taken particular interest in the doll that we're displaying called Kayla. Can you tell us about her?
So my friend Kayla, she was the very first piece of smart technology we looked at about 6 years ago now. And she's an innocent looking interactive kids dolly. So she has a microphone and a speaker and your child can talk to her. And using a Bluetooth connection, the doll can then send the voice data to a mobile phone app. And that app can then decide what the child asked it and make the doll speak a response. So she was kind of the first interactive kids toy on the market. Which is great, you know, wonderful. Kids can have an intelligent, informational, entertaining conversation with a dolly. Except.
There was definitely one of those coming.
There's a problem. Now, do you remember when you try and connect your phone to your car, your hands-free kit in the car, you have to put a pin into it? Now, that pin creates security, makes it very difficult to intercept you. However, with Kayla, there's no pin at all. And what that means is that from someone on the street outside, they can connect to the dolly without any security and can listen to the microphone so they can spy on your kids. Or even worse, they could actually talk to your children through the speaker.
Is this just someone sat outside? How far away do they have to be?
Well, it's Bluetooth range, so it's kind of next door neighbor or someone in the street outside. But it's still, someone that isn't you, isn't in your house, talking to your kids.
Is this doll available for people to buy?
Well, we, together with the Norwegian Consumer Council, reported this to various consumer protection bodies. And in the case of the German telecommunications regulator, they agreed And they banned her overnight. They decided that she was so invasive and privacy was so much at risk, particularly for children, they made it illegal to own her. And you have to pay a fine of 25,000 euros if you're caught even owning my friend Kayla.
Wow. So this is actually now quite a rarity, this doll.
Yeah, so I have a stock.
Nobody wants them, I imagine.
Yeah. It's quite creepy. Now, of course, the hacker in me wants to go further. Now, we started looking in a bit more detail at the application on the mobile phone. And you've got this sweet, innocent dolly. And we discovered through a little bit of tampering, we could actually make this doll, my friend Kayla, swear like a docket.
And if you look at her, she's adorable. She's in a sort of princess dress with long blonde hair. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and she's been the catalyst to some more regulation too. So she was cited by a US senator in California as the inspiration behind Senate Bill 328, which mandates reasonable security measures for consumer smart products in California, which is, I think, a real step forward. So hopefully we won't have so much of smart devices spying on us in the future.
That's good news as well, from frightening to actually getting a bit of positive out of it. How on earth did you get into this sort of thing, Ken?
By education, I'm a physicist, but that didn't appeal to me so much. So I ended up working in hotels and catering for a while, and was intrigued by the operation of the till systems, you know, going back into the early 90s now. And I remember successfully printing out a mortgage amortization on the restaurant bill system. At that point, the restaurant manager said to me that he felt my career lay elsewhere, which was a polite way of firing me. I then stumbled into an antivirus vendor called Dr. Solomon, some of you might remember. And from then on, I've just really been intrigued by how to make systems do things they shouldn't really do. Often we think about making computers work and do what we want, but I'm more interested in how you make them do something different. How do you do something that's outside the norm? Because there might be a security vulnerability in there, and then you've got problems.
And you describe yourself as an ethical hacker, so hacking for good.
Yeah, so we're the good guys. So we're brought in by banks and governments, and our job is, at their request, is to try and hack them in a responsible, controlled manner. The idea being is that we find the vulnerabilities, then the organization fixes them, and then the bad guys can't exploit them. Hence, ethical hacker, which sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it?
But sounds like the best job title.
When you look at a lot of the vanilla research we've done, there's a bit of a boundary between the black hat hacker, which is considered the bad guys trying to extort you, ransom your systems, get money, versus the white hat, which is more like us. Mm-hmm. Although many of them are doing it for purely altruistic reasons. But a lot of the research we do it on our own time, on our own money. We buy the kit ourselves just to try and make things a bit better. It helps us sharpen our skills, which is cool, but also it's quite fun as well. And when you start moving on to other random home appliances like your smart kettle, your toaster, your TV, your lights, that's when things get really interesting to us.
We have a smart kettle on display in the gallery. Should we wander over to it? And it's a very innocuous looking thing. What is particularly interesting about smart kettles?
So this was, again, one of the very first connected products on the market, particularly aimed at the European or UK market. You know, we want our cup of tea every morning, don't we? And there's nothing worse than going to the kettle, having to fill it up and waiting, 30 whole seconds,
right? A nightmare.
I know. So this company, a company called Smarter, came up with a concept of having a Wi-Fi connected kettle that you could boil from your phone. So wherever you were in the house, you could click a button, and by the time you got to the kitchen, you had hot water for your cuppa. Yeah, great, nice idea. I'm not quite sure whether I really need one, but the hacker in me is going, I've got to play with this. So of course, we bought a few of these. And one of my colleagues spent some time looking in detail at how the Wi-Fi connection worked. And he discovered some security flaws. First thing is it used a really unusual old network protocol called Telnet, which is unencrypted. That's a red flag straight away. It's got no security on it. And then he discovered that actually you could compromise the kettle and get it to leak your Wi-Fi password to anyone nearby. So again, the hacker could be out on the street outside or your next door neighbor. And with a few keystrokes, not complicated, you could pull out your Wi-Fi network key. And once you've got that, they're on your network.
And so in your house, aren't they?
And if you haven't changed your router admin password on your Wi-Fi router, I bet most people don't even know what one of those is,
very
right?
True. Yeah.
Then they could compromise all of your internet traffic.
Wow.
So from wanting to boil the kettle from your bedroom to having all of your home internet traffic compromised is quite a stretch, isn't it?
Not everybody will have a Wi-Fi enabled kettle in their house, but there are other objects on display here which are a little bit more ubiquitous, which some of our visitors might be a little bit more familiar with. And sat next to the kettle, we have a doorbell. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is the Ring doorbell. I'm sure many of your listeners have got one of these. Fantastic. The idea being, if you're away from your house, someone rings the doorbell and you can see who's at the door and talk to the courier maybe and tell them where to leave the package, for example. Now, we started looking at these really early on. They'd only just got to market. And we discovered on the back of it a red button. Now, it's a Wi-Fi doorbell, which means it needs to connect to your Wi-Fi router, which means it needs your Wi-Fi password. And we had a quick look and thought, hang on a minute, if we take it off, because we can unscrew it really easily and press the red button, press it, see what happens. And we could connect to it ourselves over Wi-Fi with no password needed and recover your Wi-Fi key. So from your front door of your house, we could hack your Wi-Fi router inside your house and get all your personal data. Now, in fairness, Ring were really good. They fixed it within 2 weeks, really, really responsive, which is great. But about a month later, they had a bit of an issue where they had a database corruption problem in their cloud services, which meant that you pressed your doorbell and got someone else's video feed. Now, again, that was fixed really quickly too. And Ring have had a little bit of a checkered time over the last couple of years because in some parts of the US, they were sharing data with local police forces outwardly to reduce crime, but they weren't strictly asking people for permission. And that's what bothers me. You know, if the request for data sharing is well-intentioned and you understand it and you're happy to share, great. But don't just share my data without asking.
Even honourably, the permission, the consent for it has to be there.
Absolutely. Ask the question, be super open about it, and you'll find people will be pleased to share the data. But don't just share it without asking.
Before our listeners all go to their front doors and rip their Ring doorbells or their Nest doorbells or their Wi-Fi enabled doorbells off the front of their doors, is the situation better now? Are we still finding really serious vulnerabilities or misuse of data? And is it something that could happen again?
So Ring's part of Amazon now, and of course they've got huge resources and have fixed the problem. So I have no particular concerns about Ring's security right now. So if you're going to go for a doorbell, yeah, nothing wrong with Ring, if that's your thing. But just really think carefully about what you're sharing with who and why. And would you really be better off with just a little old clunky push button that does the job?
So it's just like a little crack in the armour and that's it. The possibilities, the risks and the threats just sort of flood in then.
Yeah. Do you know, I'm not so bothered about Kayla and the kettle. The reason being is that I've got to be outside your house or I've got to be next door to your house. Mm-hmm. Where I get a bit freaked out is when you start seeing not just hacking one thing at a time, but when you can hack all the things at once.
So by having almost the password to one thing, that gives you the password to the whole set.
Yeah, so think about how your mobile app talks to your smart things. So it doesn't just go straight from the phone, straight to your thing. It has to go into the cloud usually. It goes to the manufacturer and they work out who you are and they make sure they authenticate you properly and then tell your device in your home to do the right thing. And the problem happens is when that cloud platform isn't properly secured. And we've seen numerous cases. A great example was some smart locks we looked at a while back. And we found a problem in the cloud platform. It meant we could unlock everyone's lock at once. Not just one, the whole lot.
Are these like door locks, padlocks?
Yes.
Wow. Which could be securing someone's lockup or someone's home or...
your front door.
Yeah.
The bit that made it really bad for us is once we got that data, we could also get the GPS coordinates of where the locks were.
My goodness.
So it's a recipe, it's a ticket, it's a how-to for a burglar. With a little bit of tech savvy, you can go and break into lots of people's houses.
You're making these devices sound terrifying. We should be incredibly suspicious of them. Do you feel that we're just letting ourselves in for a whole lot of danger by using these devices? Or do you feel a little bit more balanced about it?
I think things are improving a bit. So Kayla got banned, the kettle's no longer on the market, and the latest version from the company is actually a lot more secure. So you know, if you want to boil water remotely, that's the way to do it now. Mm-hmm. So things are improving, but there's still a lot of products in the market, even now, brand new products that just aren't safe enough. And I think we as consumers have got a bit of responsibility. We need to be asking questions. We need to be asking manufacturers about the security of these products and not just putting up with mumbo jumbo, actually pushing harder. And that's where I like some of the labeling schemes that are being talked about right now. Because mm-hmm. It means that you and me, when we go onto Amazon or into a retailer, we can look at the sticker and go, well, that one's better than that one. And I'm going to spend my money on a little bit more money on a product that I know is secure. And I think by us influencing the direction of travel, actually manufacturers will up their game.
So you think to some extent consumers have a responsibility, manufacturers have a responsibility. Is there a regulatory responsibility as well?
Regulation's a really interesting one, and lots of different authorities around the world are doing different things. So, for example, I mentioned in the US that we've got California driving in one direction and various other US states are doing similar things. In the UK, we've got the Department for Culture, Media and Sport are actually doing some good stuff. They consulted over the last couple of years, got some really good advice from industry and research groups and manufacturers, and they came up with a really good starter. So forcing organizations to support products for a period of time, forcing organizations to listen to security researchers, which is great because if we find stuff, we know they're going to fix it. And also just getting commitment to how long the product's going to be out in the market for and how long they will support it for. So it's a really good step in the right direction. There's a long way to go, but it's definitely going the right way.
And it's work that people like you do that helps to expose the weaknesses that strengthen the products of the future.
Yeah, and there are some manufacturers who are really good. You know, you reach out to them and say, we found a really bad vulnerability. So you tell them quietly about it. And they're like, brilliant, thank you so much. And within a couple of days, they fixed it all. And you're like, well done. Yeah, do you know what? We're actually going to write something and say how good this manufacturer was. Because the next time, we know they're going to be responsible and fix stuff and look after our customer data. But most of the times, you send them some details and you never hear from them again.
Oh, no.
And that's when things end up in the press.
Of course. I have to ask you, what is the coolest thing you've ever ethically hacked?
Oh, my gosh. The list is big.
You're trying to work out what is he allowed to talk about.
There's some things I definitely can't talk about. And if you look at our blog, you'll know why. At the moment, we're spending quite a bit of time working on aeroplanes.
Wow.
Now, one of the kind of silver linings of a sort from the coronavirus downturn has meant a lot of aeroplanes have been laid up or retired for a period of time. And it's given independent researchers like us an opportunity to get into scrapyards and figure out how aeroplanes work. Now, don't get me wrong, planes are safe. You are far more likely to have a crash in your car on the way to the airport than in the plane itself. But that's not to say it's perfect. And the manufacturers have actually been really good. They spent a lot of time working on security. But there's still areas that could get even better. So we've been spending time looking at all sorts of different aeroplanes, from Airbuses to Boeings, from 747s to Airbus 320s, all sorts of fun stuff, learning about how planes work and how their security works and seeing where there might be opportunities for things to get better.
As I'd said, you're an expert in the field, but you're also one of our lenders to the exhibition. So some of your items are on display. Kayla is on loan, thanks to you. What do you think about the Never Alone exhibition? What's your impression?
I walked in here a little earlier today and I was blown away. I love it. I've been to Bletchley Park many times because I live nearby. But coming in and seeing the spying, smart, innocent doll, Kayla, in context with spying activities from the war, I think is absolutely amazing. It makes us realize that privacy, information is absolutely everything. And I think hopefully we'll make people think a bit more carefully about what's important in the data that they have and they share with organizations. Maybe read the terms and conditions in a bit more detail next time, and maybe ask more probing questions or just decide not to buy something if you're not happy about it. Information is currency. It was the currency of the war. It's the currency of big technology companies now. So just think about the value of what you do and what you share.
What they said was that we were listening to the German Air Force and nothing more. And I rather think it was really a bit broader than that at times, but then nothing was ever said.
And so you listened to, it was Morse, I presume, and it was just to you random letters.
It was a 5-letter code.
Yeah.
And of course it would be in the German code, wouldn't it? And you were just sort of listening on your frequency and then just swinging either side of that and listening to that. But nothing was ever said about anything. It was a bit boring.
You wrote these down on a form, on a pad, would that be right?
Oh, yes, it was a special form.
Yeah.
I think about 4 or 5 columns, and what you heard went into the blocks as words sort of thing.
And when a signal had finished, what happened then? Who did you give it to?
As far as we knew, they were collected up and sent to Bletchley by dispatch riders. Yeah.
But did you know at the time where they were going? Did they actually mention a place called Bletchley Park?
No, not to begin with. It was an X station.
In order to gather together the contemporary objects for our Never Alone exhibition, Bletchley Park sent out a call, which we referred to as a gadget amnesty. And we sent this out to local schools, our staff and volunteers, and other friends of Bletchley Park to ask people to loan us their devices. We also asked those who lent us their things to tell us a little bit about their gadgets, and you can read these testimonies on labels in the exhibition gallery. One of our very kind lenders is Amy Doolan, who joins us on the podcast. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the objects that you have loaned to the Never Alone exhibition?
I've loaned two objects. They're called magic bands. They come from the Walt Disney World Resort in Florida.
What are these bands? What do they do when you're at this park in Florida?
They do so much while you're on site. So they are your room key, your park tickets, use for fast passes, which means you have a shortened wait time for rides, photo pass, which is the photographers on site, as well as ride photos, exchanging for food credits, as well as charging back to the room and then sending the merchandise back to the room so I don't have to carry it. It means now I can go into the parks without a bag and carrying nothing as everything is on my wrist. They also help in unexpected ways as well. When my grandmother went out alone to a shop in another part of the resort, she had an accident that required medical assistance, and a staff member just scanned a band to find out what room she was staying in, called us in the room to inform us of what's happened. At the time, she didn't carry a phone, so it was just a quick way to let us know that she was okay and for someone to potentially go back and meet her. So it does an incredible amount.
These things sound amazing. I just want to ask you, have you been to a Disney park without these bands? And does it feel like a different visit?
Yes, so since becoming a regular visitor to Disneyland Paris, it is definitely a big change. When I went last time, everything was on separate cards. So everything I've just listed would have been on individual plastic or cards that you had to carry around with you. As well as they're not linked to any mobiles, you had to physically go to a site to schedule anything. So it's definitely a change in how you visit.
Do you take these bands home with you, or do you have to give them back at the end and you've just managed to acquire these bands that you've lent us?
No, so they are yours to keep afterwards, and you can actually buy other ones while you're there with more characters and what more interesting things on them. So I actually have a bigger collection than my trips because I bought some while I was there. But it is just a good souvenir to remind you as well. And you can actually use them on future trips and reactivate them. The yellow magic band that I have on loan in the museum is actually still active.
Oh, wow.
And you can use it.
Fantastic. And do they work after you've left the park? Do they do anything at all other than be a souvenir? Can you sort of activate them outside?
They don't really do anything once you've left. They just kind of look like nice bracelets if you want them, but otherwise they don't really do anything.
So you say that these bands, they help Disney staff know your location and they help get you into things and out of things and pay for things. What sort of information does Disney gather using these bands? Can you give us an idea about what information they take from you and what they might do with that information?
So I can give you an idea of what I think they might gather, because I don't think they explicitly say anywhere exactly what they do. From what I can understand is that they can track how many times you enter different parks in a day or if you do more than one. But as they've been doing that since the entire time I've been going to Disney, since 2000, that's not anything particularly new. But they may look at other things like buying patterns. So, you know, when are you buying these things as well? But also just maybe other aspects that I haven't thought of. So, you know, do I use them for certain things? Don't I use them for certain things? But they could honestly have told me what they use this information for. The paperwork that comes with booking these trips is about 15 or more pages. So I'm not sure if it is there, but there is a good chance it could be. But what I look at it in a way that, what would I not want them to know? I mean, is it going to be a big difference to my life if they know how many times I visit Epcot in one trip? Because I don't really hide how often I visit. So it's interesting to see what they would do, but I'm not sure if it would affect me too deeply.
You seem to have a pretty good idea about the sorts of ways they might maybe use the information, if not kind of influence you back again, for example, marketing or potentially sending you information that's targeted to your particular behaviour on the site. Do you think it is a good thing or a bad thing about the level of or the detail of information that Disney are collecting on you? Or are you kind of indifferent to it?
I'm kind of a bit indifferent to it because the most important information that they have about me comes in every single general hotel booking. So where you live, and your contact details. None of these are connected to the patterns they'll be using. They'll be using it for more to improve the parks in terms of capacity, in terms of crowding, which in more recent times has become really important. And just looking maybe at where they could increase staffing levels, maybe because they can see when people are buying things and when people are entering the site. So all those things may be for just improving performance throughout the resort rather than knowing specific individual information about me. The resort does have 21 million visitors a year, so I'm not sure how individual they'll be going, rather just looking at it from just a, you know, how much people are buying over the scope rather than minute information about single people.
And do other people in your family use these bands as well when you go and visit the parks?
Yes, we have been using them since 2016. It was introduced in 2013, but we've been using them since then. We have every age in our family, right up to my grandparents who are in their late 70s when they were using these bands. It did take a lot to explain to them how they worked, particularly within terms of getting into the room, thinking, oh, if someone nicked our band, they can have access to our room. And then explaining that there are so many rooms, it's not linked, and it would be very impossible to find out where we were staying. They have been the ones asking more specific questions like that, particularly as your credit card is linked to the band. But as you have to use a fingerprint to access it, it's not a big deal then. But they've never really asked any deeper details, as even if you do lose the band, it's not even your real name on the bands. I know a lot of people who stick nicknames and Disney characters and all sorts on the inside of the bands. I've just put my name because it's only three letters, so it's not going to give a lot away about me. But it is interesting that other people have asked me these questions and we haven't considered it.
And if you could change anything about how the bands work, for good, for bad, or whatever, how would you change them, do you think?
I did think this was a very good question. As the main thing I wanted them to change was about functionality, and they did change that between version 1 and version 2. I have both of those versions on display, just because the version 1 didn't sit on the wrist very well, and they amended that for version 2. But in terms of technology-wise, I can't really think of any aspect to add on because there is so much already on there that I don't think they can think of anything else on there, because this project to implement this into the site cost over $1 billion.
Wow, goodness.
So I don't think they want to add or change too much at the moment because it was a major investment and it did take over 2 years to implement.
And Disney being Disney, coming up with a good idea about how to use them sounds like it's right in their ballpark. So
yeah, the development for them took a long time. And I think with the change in how we use mobile technology and just the change in technology has just made it happen. We've gone from, you know, little cards with people physically stamping on them the first time my parents visiting. Now we can book everything on a mobile.
It's incredible. I actually wanted to ask you about the display of these Disney bands. So we've put them in the Never Alone exhibition in the tracking section, alongside things like Fitbits and digital pedometers. In that section, we ask our visitors, is it worth sharing your biological and medical data with private companies in order to monitor your health and fitness? So it's a sort of a health rather than a behavioral tracking. But I wanted to ask you what your answer to that question would be. Do you think it's worth sharing?
Yeah, so that is a very good question as well, because things on Fitbits are definitely more personal than there are on Magic Bands, because I know a lot of people put a lot more data into it themselves, not necessarily from what is automatically tracked, such as your footsteps and heart rate. I actually have one, so I am used to using it. But it is, I think, the additional data that's perhaps more worrying, that you can put in how much water you're drinking, how much you're doing this, how much you're exercising, in addition to the data they're already collecting. So they are gathering even more data from you than we can expect. I mean, I've had a good experience with Fitbit in the past. My Fitbit was actually hacked at one point by someone and they noted me instantly and I got it sorted just as I was about to board a plane as well. So they do take data seriously. So they must know how much information that they gathered just from how quickly they reacted to me when I told them that it has been hacked.
I can see you're wearing your Fitbit there. So in general, you think it's a reasonable thing to share the data that you have, and the understanding that Fitbit are a reputable company and that they're dealing with that information in a good way.
Yes, that's because they are such a major company as well. And I only use it to track steps so I don't sit down all day.
Do you think your opinion has changed at all since the pandemic? Obviously, we're more familiar with things like track and trace, and people are using the ability for larger organizations, corporations, governments to have information on their location, for example, or their behavior, they're sharing that potentially more now and we're accepting it more. Has your opinion at all changed since the pandemic hit us in terms of what information you're willing to share?
Yeah, so this is another question that we had when Track and Trace came in and we started scanning every shop we went into. We did wonder exactly what they would do with this information. I don't know how knowing a 26-year-old visits a lot of antique shops is going to help them plan the future in any way. But it is an interesting thought that they'd be knowing exactly where you're going at what time. So it's kind of the same thing Disney does on site with knowing those things. But I think the government should know already where you live.
I think you seem pretty happy with the level of information that you're sharing. You don't seem to see it as a sacrifice necessarily.
Not necessarily, because if you have to look at it the other way, it is to determine if you're going to be in contact with anyone who might have the disease. And I think the disease was a bigger risk to me than knowing that I visit the Costa and Olney.
Mm-hmm.
Especially living with someone who was shielding, it was more important just to make sure that I could be contacted any way that I might be, you know, connected to that. But you'd hope the government would be considered a reputable company. I think with the year go on and we start to open up again, we'll be back to photographing every time we enter somewhere. And hopefully this time, maybe as the year goes on, we just understand a little bit more where this information is going to be. They might publish something.
I wanted to ask about the exhibition itself. As one of our lenders, you have obviously lent your Disney vans very kindly to the exhibition for display, but you also work in the museum sector yourself. How does it feel being part of our Never Alone Gadget Amnesty?
What I liked about this exhibition was the fact that the objects came from the community and they had an actual life in terms of materiality before they were displayed. They're not just an unknown object. They had its purpose used before they were loaned out. I look at my objects knowing that they were used for their original purpose, along with the other objects and anecdotes presented alongside them as the display. I do think it does bring a deeper layer to the interpretation.
It's really interesting you say that as well about them having had a former life around before they were placed on these Perspex plinths and became display objects. One of the things we struggled with the Gadget Amnesty was parting people from their gadgets and actually people allowing us to put things on display that would mean for a number of months they weren't able to have them in the house or to use them. So for a start, it's fantastic that you have a collection of Disney vans and you're willing to lend us a proportion of that collection. But I think it's been really, you're absolutely right about the community participation and people being willing to just to let go of their gadgets. I think if there was anything we'd found out from the people who'd lent us the gadgets, is they generally have quite a positive opinion of their gadgets. Do you have any other smart devices or gadgets in your house or that you personally own that you feel maybe less confident about than, say, your Fitbit and your Disney vans?
I don't have any particular gadgets that I think I'm not as confident with as other gadgets, because I think I'm always a bit cynical and behind the times anyway. But my neighbours do have one of those Ring doorbells that they use, you know, as like a CCTV camera at the same time as not just checking their Amazon parcels. And you're just worried, you know, would that be hacked? You could see right outside your front door and their car sits right outside their front door. So you get even more information.
It's a bit of cynicism at the same time. I like that.
Yeah.
Thank you ever so much for talking to us and telling us about the objects that you've lent to the exhibition. It's been a treat, Amy.
Thank you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.